Our second speaker today, former ISI National Director, former attorney with a prestigious Wall Street firm, once had a real job, too, when he was a Heritage Foundation intern. Today, really, one of the token Southerners in the White House, having received his law degree from the University of Virginia, being a native of South Carolina, and having received his bachelor's degree from another institution in the state of Virginia. It's told by Ken fairly often that Thanksgiving time of the freshman year, when he went back home after some travail in the family, particularly from his grandmother, who was very much concerned that he was going to that Yankee school, Washington and Lee, up north in Virginia. Anyway, he came home, and his grandmother inquired at Thanksgiving time as to how things were up north. And Ken said, well, Grandma, I just love it up there at WNL. And she said, Kenneth, you are picking up all those despicable northern habits like using abbreviations. If you are going to abbreviate, please abbreviate correctly. It is W.N. Lee. Our speaker is a 12-year member of the Philadelphia Society, a former board member of the Philadelphia Society, and currently assistant counselor to the President of the United States, Ken Cribb.
Ed, if you think my grandmother was unreconstructed, you ought to get to know my mother. She's so conservative, she's against discussion. In fact, the only political dialogue I ever hear in my house is at the time of the evening news with Dan Rather, and anywhere in the house you can hear her shouting, "Jackass!" Well, our topic this afternoon is the crisis in American institutions. And when Don Lipsett told me that was what we were to address, I remembered that 8 or 10 years ago, when Russell Kirk and Malcolm Muggeridge appeared at Dartmouth under ISI auspices and discussed the true crisis of our time. And as you can suspect already, their real subject was theological. But along the way, working up to that subject, they gently mocked the propensity to anoint as a crisis any problem that happens to achieve the scrutiny of students of current affairs. And of course, even if crisis may be too acute and dramatic a term for the situation in Washington, there are serious problems with our institutions across the board, not just political institutions. And I take it that the very makeup of this panel points toward an analysis of the difficulties that we face, more particularly with the politics and the political institutions. The most frequent sentiment I hear expressed these days about our political situation is the profound frustration of conservatives that a conservative Republican president and a Republican Senate has not done more over the past 3 years to correct the mistakes and right the wrongs of decades of liberal dominance and moderate acquiescence. And I share that frustration. There have been some improvements, of course. Inflation is down, interest rates are down, all they're rising again. Regulatory burden has been eased, at least that which we can reach by fiat. Phil and those have to cooperate for the rest of it. Defense spending is up. Military pay has been increased. Strategic forces are being modernized. Conventional forces are being brought up to strength. Not one additional country has been brought under communist domination since Reagan became president. No Americans are being held hostage by a hostile power. And Soviet-backed adventurism in Grenada was spectacularly foiled. We have a president who condemns abortion, who leads the charge for school prayer and tuition tax credits, who stands unabashedly for traditional values against the social sophisters and calculators of our age. The bully pulpit has been refurbished, and the preacher is a man of the right, and that's an improvement. But much remains to be done, and in fact, many opportunities to do more have already been lost, and conservatives are understandably impatient. Sometimes when I'm confronted with one of my exercised brethren from the conservative movement. I feel like the South Carolina man who was accused of being drunk and setting his hotel bed on fire. When he was hauled before the judge the next day, he said, "Your Honor, I admit to being drunk last night, but that bed was on fire when I got in it." And I just want to say that bed was on fire when I got in it. But conservatives are justifiably frustrated at our utter failure to get spending under control and our inability to tame whole wasp nests of the bureaucracy, our failure to seize opportunities for further discrete advances in a host of areas, the paucity of our rhetorical skill in changing the terms of the debate on civil rights and the so-called fairness issue. One could go on and on. In fact, one probably will go on and on. But in response to these frustrations, I would like to make three modest observations. One is that power wielded beneficently in our system meets the same obstacles as power wielded destructively, and that as conservatives, we should probably affirm those obstacles and applaud the limits that they place on even beneficent government action. The second observation is where conservatives in the administration could have gone further, they have been foiled by some tactical errors and difficulties that I'll describe in a moment. And the third point I'll make is that the same myopia, which views every problem as a crisis, also focuses too exclusively on politics and political institutions as if they were the only important measure of the health of our culture and of its broader institutions. Now, the first point I made is certainly a commonplace, but it's not a matter I hear factored in the bitter conservative discussions on the current state of affairs, so let me just state the commonplace. The doctrine of separation of powers and the system of checks and balances instituted to enforce that separation were expressly designed to ensure that no player in the game of national politics walks away with all the marbles, even if he carries 45 states. Now, Madison wrote in Federalist 51, "The great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachment of the others. The provision for defense in this must, as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government, but what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" So it's not merely the balancing of abstract constitutional powers that was contemplated, but also envisaged was that at least some officials would wield that power from motives having very little to do with the public interest, but that even that self-interested action would operationally reinforce the separation that was desired. Now, this doctrine, with its attendant institutional and personal jealousies, is a stumbling block to implementation of the conservative agenda. It is also a stumbling block for which we will be grateful at that inevitable hour when our opponents once again achieve political power. As one senior conservative Republican senator said last Tuesday, in the face of the delaying tactics of the Democrats on his committee, he said, "Just wait till we get back in the minority." All right, but even given the institutional bias in our own arrangements against sweeping change, why has a putatively conservative regime not made more progress in 3 years? I'll make three points in this regard. First, I think that we are too preoccupied with victory, especially legislative victory. It's the "let's not ask for more than we'll get" syndrome. And this is especially prevalent in the budget area, where we fund bad programs at too high a level because it is certain that Congress would reject more stringent cuts. The contrary tactic, which I happen to personally favor, is to stake out what we consider the correct position and the one consistent with our mandate, and let Congress bear the responsibility for defeating that position, if they will. this is the tactic that we pursued on tuition tax credits and on school prayer. In both instances, the possibility of favorable House action was judged to be nil, and the prospects in the Senate were not good. And yet the managers of those issues, with the emphatic endorsement of the president, sought and achieved a record vote in the Senate. Now, the sheep have been separated from the goats on these important issues. The liberals and moderates who have spent years in waffling on school prayer and tuition tax credits are now on the record, and may their constituents judge them accordingly. After the tuition tax credits vote, there was a meeting of the coalition supporting that movement in the cabinet room, and then the head of the Knights of the Columbus said to the president, "Mr. Reagan, 10 Catholic senators from heavily Catholic states voted against tuition tax credits, and that, sir, is not your problem, that's our problem." So there's hope. Well, the thirst after empty victory is not the only unhelpful syndrome that's prevalent among members of the administration. A second break on our forward motion is that we have our share of flak catchers who don't enjoy being mau-mau'd. To those of my colleagues who left to their own devices would govern the country in reaction to the pages of the Washington Post, nothing is more discomforting than to be criticized in the establishment press. Any special interest group that holds a press conference and whose pratings about fairness are reported by advocacy journalists can put in jeopardy the most prudent and well-thought-out policy. Now, such policies are frequently sustained by the charge of the aroused bull meese or by the steadfastness of the president himself, but there are casualties along the way, and too many casualties. There's the whole area of personnel appointments. Will is in the audience, and she'll tell you this from her own experience, but how is a conservative president to master the federal leviathan when he can appoint only a few top people in any department or agency? How, in turn, are those presidential appointees to master the tens of thousands of career civil servants who work under them? Well, of course, there are ways, but they're not readily apparent to most of the people that get these jobs. You know, there are two schools of thought. First holds the president should only appoint experienced, credentialed individuals. Now, this very often means that the job goes to someone who previously held it or something like it. Well, you can imagine what the chances are for innovation and reform under those circumstances. Or such second school holds the president should appoint people who strongly agree with them, even if they lack Washington experience. Well, I hold to the second view as opposed to the first. But there's a drawback there. Such people, despite their ties to the president, their loyalty to him, will be at a disadvantage, by definition, in dealing with entrenched bureaucrats and the rest of the Washington power establishment that knows better than he how to work their will. And, you know, and as a result, some of our best people get frustrated and leave, and some people for whom we have high hopes are almost immediately co-opted by career staffs who can make life very comfortable for you if you're willing to eat of the lotus. Because Fulmer is wielding such a mean gavel, you are mercifully spared from a quote from Henry Adams. But let me take the instance of Jim Watt, who is a special case because he is a Reagan loyalist, a genuine conservative, and a Washington outsider, who nevertheless knew the Interior Department well and understood exactly what needed to be done as soon as he took over. He's an able administrator. He ran his department. Instead of letting it run him, he accomplished much, and he was hounded from office. What hurt Jim Watt was a propensity to make off-the-cuff remarks that the liberal establishment would have overlooked or downplayed had they been uttered by one of their favorites. You remember what Gaylord Nelson said when Watt was resigned? He said, "It's like seeing your mother-in-law go over a cliff in a new Cadillac." Well, now, if Jim Watt had said that, he would have been lambasted by feminists for denigrating women, by mothers-in-laws for perpetuating an offensive stereotype, by Ralph Nader for promoting bad driving habits, and by Senator Metzenbaum for using his public office to plug General Motors. Well, my time is elapsing here, so let me just say that those are some of the circumstances, and there are others, that make it difficult to convert more completely on the conservative political victory of 1980. But lest we become too disheartened, we should also remind ourselves that the 1980 victory itself was made possible by deeper cultural currents, partially set in motion by the intellectual conservative recrudescence of the late 40s and 50s, and a phenomenon largely inspired by Dr. Kirk, who we honored today, and built upon ever since by the occupants of this room and your fellow travelers. There's no doubt that we have had partial success in the battle of ideas, that the parameters of discourse have shifted to the right, and that we are in fact consolidating our gains. The fact of these gains is instinctive to all of us here who we remember 10 or 15 years ago when all of us knew every conservative of consequence in the country. That's clearly impossible now. When I started with ISI, there were 200 scholars we called upon. When I worked for Ed Follner, when we were doing a project on the conservative public policy expertise, I think we identified about 1,000 in the mid-70s. Now it takes a whole department of the Heritage Foundation even to keep up with the new entrants in the field. I mean, we're a burgeoning productive movement. But whatever the strengths and weaknesses of the current political leadership, our intellectual revival will have enduring influence. And just as it seems to produce the climate for conservative political victories of the 80s, so too we are beginning to see the impact on the broad culture. Bruce Chapman, who is the former director of the Census and currently head of the Office of Planning and Evaluation at the White House, cites clear evidence in the demographic testing and cultural surveys to suggest, insofar as they tell us anything, to suggest that the values which have been proclaimed and nurtured by Kirk and Niemeyer and Buckley and Bradford and Evans and Crane for all these years are beginning to take hold. The 1980s are not the 1960s. Well, I suggested at the outset that that crisis may be too strong a term to use for what's going on in our political institutions. And I did that to help remind myself that even though I, like many of you, spend all my waking hours in politics, that we are really only working at the margin of what's important in our culture, and or more aptly for our discussion, that the political institutions that we are focusing on now in this panel are really surface phenomena. If every politician in Washington should have displayed in his office the lines Dr. Johnson contributed to Goldsmith's poem, The Traveler, how small of all that human hearts endure, that part which laws or kings can cause or cure. The bad news is that laws and kings aren't doing a very spectacular job in Washington. The good news is that the bad news doesn't have very much to do with those aspects of the human condition that are of real importance.